This is episode number 215 of the Well-Fed Women podcast. You are now listening to Well-Fed Women, the show that's been radically changing the way women perceive health, fitness, and their bodies since 2015. I'm your host, Noelle Tarr. Submit your questions to wellfedwomen@gmail.com, and you can keep up with the show on Instagram at wellfedwomen. Welcome back to the show. I'm Noelle Tarr, nutritional therapy practitioner and certified personal trainer. I am here today with a guest co-host. I'm so excited to interview Meg, and I'm sure so many of you have heard about her or heard her on other podcasts, making her podcast tours, but she has some great insight. We got so many great questions specifically about fertility, and we're going to dive deep into the topic today. So before we jump in, I want to first thank our sponsors. First and foremost, if you've been thinking about the NTA program, this is an awesome time to jump in. And they have really been what I've been watching over the past 5 years since I got my NTP certification. They have been refining this program. And what they have right now is such a beautiful course that is so fine-tuned and well-developed, and there's so much good research, and there is even a lot of really good information about how to start a business, what to do with your credentials. They've really developed this into a comprehensive, holistic nutrition education course that I recommend for anybody who is interested in learning more to help their families, themselves, or to work one-on-one with clients, or to start an online business and help people in a greater capacity or in a group setting. So the Nutritional Therapy Association can be found at nutritionaltherapy.com. When you go there, right on the main page, you will see something said. There's like a mini course that they have. I really highly recommend that you click on that button that says start the free course, and you'll get a really great free education, mini course education, but you also get a really good insight into what the program is about. So you can do the NTP program, which is more comprehensive, and you actually have in-person workshops, or you can do the NTC program, which is fully online. All the information's on their website. When you sign up, if you decide to, and I do have a full post on my blog about my experience with the NTP or getting an NTP certification in the NTA. So I'll link to that in the show notes. But if you need to email me and you have any questions, feel free to do that. When you're filling out the application, put Well-Fed Women in the referral section, and they're going to give me your information, and I'll send you a free signed copy of Coconuts and Kettlebells to get you started on learning and more about your education. Second thing, so that's nutritionaltherapy.com. Second thing, Thrive Market. Y'all, this is it's always a great time to try Thrive Market, but thrivemarket.com/wellfedwomen, you'll get 25% off your first purchase with them. This is a great opportunity. I'm telling you what, if you have not tried Thrive Market, this is the place where you can get basically everything that you can find at Whole Foods, except it's like at Costco prices with this like Amazon Prime twist where you get nice free shipping when you spend over a certain amount, which is a very low minimum, so you'll always hit it. And they have everything that you'll find at Whole Foods, except it's way below retail price. And that they do this, they get these prices because they cut out the middleman. And so you get stuff shipped directly to you. It's all the stuff you're going to find, all the brands that you're using. I will talk about this in upcoming episodes, but my husband was actually just diagnosed with Hashimoto's, which is an autoimmune thyroid condition. We've talked about it a lot on here and interviewed a lot of thyroid experts. And I mean, the first place I went was Thrive Market to try to find condiments and things that I can cook with, for example, like red boat fish sauce and coconut aminos and things that I could use to add flavor to our dishes that were autoimmune paleo friendly, which following an autoimmune paleo protocol is pretty restrictive and it is very limiting. And I'm so thankful that I have an opportunity to search Thrive Market and find paleo and egg-free and all these, you know, products that are specific to our restrictions and our very strict dietary needs at this point. So I'll dive into what we're doing more in the future, but this is the kind of resource that Thrive Market is. You'll find all of these really great brands, you know, and also things like supplements and cooking oils and snacks and baby and household items. So it's got everything, all non-GMO, tons of organic stuff. ThriveMarket.com/wellfedwomen. Give it a try. Okay. So excited to have Meg on. I want to read her bio real quick. Also known as Meg the Midwife, or just Meg, she is the co-founder of Baby Making and Beyond, a registered midwife and women's wellness coach. Meg holds a BSCH in midwifery with honors and has extensive education in functional nutrition and women's health. She's been a full-time midwife since 2009 and literally delivered hundreds of babies. Meg has also worked as a midwifery and family medicine clinical instructor, as well as a backcountry chef. Oh, that's wonderful. Her clients continually inspire her to keep learning and help others to make positive changes in their lives, teaching others to listen to their inner wisdom and guidance of their bodies is something she loves to share. Oh, and she has an insatiable taste for adventure, and you'll often find her up high in the mountains when not working with women or riding. You have a lot going on, Meg. This is exciting. I didn't realize you were a backcountry chef. Like,
you know, how that manifested was I love backcountry skiing, and on all my holiday times, I'll often go up to a backcountry ski lodge, and I love food. I mean, as most of your listeners do, as you do as well. And I would just end up always in the kitchen with the cook. And I just thought, you know, I just like love doing this. So on my now my holiday weeks, I will go up to these backcountry lodges and do all of the food, but also ski all day.
That's
so
awesome.
It's not so relaxing, but it gives me a lot of pleasure. I love feeding people. I think it's how we show love and affection towards the ones that we care about.
Oh, totally. That's so fun. I just love when we're able to express ourselves in multiple ways. And I know you get a lot of fulfillment out of being a midwife and helping women in this capacity at such an important time in their lives and with such important topics that hit us, you know, hard. But then you also have this cool thing where you're like backcountry skiing and you're being a chef and all that kind of stuff. And it's just cool to have so many different facets of what you do and what you're passionate about. So
totally. It's important to care for yourself too and do the things that fill you up personally as well as professionally. And I get that professionally for sure.
Yeah.
It's the part that I have struggled with balance, you know, as a midwife, you're on call, you know, sometimes, I mean, I remember one year I was on call 320 days that year, and it's hard to have balance when you're on call that much. However, it's a lifestyle that I love. I'm happy to be of service.
So what made you so passionate about midwifery care? And what was the moment that you were like, I want to be a midwife? Like, how was that? You know, how did you get there? Because I always wonder if people have that interest from the get-go. Like when they get into school, they're like, I'm going to be a midwife, or it's something that sparks as they're going through their education.
Yeah, that's a good question. I always knew I wanted to be in a caring profession. That was really clear to me right from the time I was a little kid, you know, playing with Barbies. And I would set up, you know, free clinics for my Barbie and Ken dolls. And they would come in and they would actually have babies all the time, which I don't think is an abnormal thing for a little girl to do, to be curious about that. But when I started my journey in university, I was thinking about pre-med. So I was taking pre-med courses and I shadowed some physicians. And then I met this woman who was a midwife and I thought, huh, interesting. And I started talking to her and I learned, you know, kind of what the main tenets of midwifery practice were, which is choice of birthplace. So the belief that a woman should be able to give birth in whatever place she's most comfortable in, providing that it's a safe choice. Informed choice. That was a really big one for me. So not so much, you know, giving consent for a procedure or, you know, anything, which is how the mainstream medical model works, but it's really giving women solid evidence-based information and being their guide as they make their own choices and then supporting the choices that women make. To me, that was like hands down, oh, I definitely want to do this. And then the other main tenet that I fell in love with was the continuity of care principle. So the idea that the person that delivers your baby will be known to you. And here in Canada, midwives, you'll never meet more than four midwives in your group. So, you should have a pretty established relationship with your midwife when she delivers your baby and cares for your family. So I thought that was pretty cool, too. So I went out and I became a doula at the ripe old age of 19. And then I was like, okay, well, I don't think I can like charge for my doula services, because like who wants a 19-year-old hanging out at their birth being like, yeah, hey, I'm here to help. So I just did that for free for years. At that time in Canada, there weren't really any universities that were offering a midwifery education program. Midwifery was just getting funded and legislated provincially, because here in Canada we have our healthcare is all funded, and midwifery was going from being non-funded and kind of private to into the mainstream medical model. So I wanted to wait it out. During those years, you know, I like went and did a lot of skiing. I worked as a professional snowboarder for a while. I spent my time frolicking in the hills. And then finally, when there was a program that I was in love with, I committed to it. And I did my 4 years at university training in midwifery. And in Canada, you're not a nurse, you're just a midwife. So you spend a solid full 4 years just delivering babies and learning about the model of informed choice and all of the sociological kind of stuff that goes with midwifery. And then that was it. I was like pretty much hooked. And now it's been, so I've been attending births now for, how old am I now? So 20 years. That's a long time.
That is a long time.
She sounds super old. So it's probably been like thousands of babies and thousands of women that I've cared for, which is like such a privilege and such an honor.
Yeah, I'm sure you learned so much in that time. And I think that one of the cool things about what you do and what I think any practitioner does is that you learn so much more as you're helping other people and as you're actually practicing. You know, so many people are so scared to get started with anything, any sort of business that puts them in a client, you know, person relationship, or in your case, a patient, you know, professional relationship. And it's really those times like that you said, this past 20 years, I mean, you're just constantly learning. And that's part of the fun of the work, you know, is what you're learning as you get to help others. And yeah. So that's really cool. Now, are you still actively being a midwife, or have you transitioned to mostly helping women online?
So right now I'm helping women online for this next year. As many people might know, I've had my own struggles with hormone imbalance, and it took me a long time to figure that out, mostly because I was a midwife. And what I found for me, the biggest piece that I needed that was missing in my puzzle in order to solve my hormone imbalances were the circadian rhythm piece. And as a midwife, you have no guarantee of a solid circadian rhythm. And so I'm spending the next year and a bit just working online and just making sure that my body is healthy moving forward, because I want to keep doing this for a long time. I also need to make sure that I'm caring for myself. So I'm taking a bit of my own advice right now and sleeping in my bed every night. And it's pretty great. Although I do miss it, and I will be going back to it shortly.
So what you're saying is your job, which you're extremely passionate about, because I think that this is really important. This is not part of the question or the interview, but I do think that this is really, really important. And so many people are like, I want her to talk more about that. Your job and what you do and what you love to do is actually semi-detrimental to your health.
Oh, it's 100% detrimental to my health.
Yes. Okay. So I'm glad you said that. I was trying. Okay. So
I don't think you'll need a midwife. Down in the States, you guys have models where midwives can work shifts that are a little bit more reasonable than being on call for 320 days. But in Canada, that's not really part of our model. And I think that'll change here because there's a lot of midwives that say the same thing. We're all very much in the same boat, and our bodies are also unique and different and change over time. And, you know, there was no amount of supplements or food that would fix my problems. And the biggest thing was sleep. And so it took me years to admit that, years, because it's so hard to leave something you love. So yeah, I'm really glad that I took that leap. And I think, you know, you just have to be brave and be honest about what your body needs, and you'll be better off for it.
Mm. So you've kind of had to, you've been forced to make shifts to create a better situation for your health. Not to say that you can't help people in the same way. And it, like what you're doing right now is a very different thing, but you're still helping people in the same way. But also, if you want to deliver babies again, you might be able to shift back to that. Mm-hmm. However, you know, for this time being, it's you had to make some serious life changes just to work on your health. You know, that's an important point.
You can't care for others if you don't care well for yourself. And that includes, you know, being a practitioner, but it also includes being a mom and a partner. You just can't do it. And so, yeah, I'll be looking into finding a practice where I'm not on call for more than 24 hours at a time and probably, you know, never working 320 days a year again. I think I just have to accept that and move on.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we have so many questions, Meg, and I want to jump right into them. I have this set up in a way so that we can talk about very general topics, but then we are going to get into some nitty-gritty details of fertility and pregnancy and all the postpartum things. And so let's first start with our question from Stephanie Overstreet. What are some key steps to take in preparing to conceive? So I think that this is a big question for a lot of women. What, you know, what are the kind of big ideas? What can we do when we're thinking about, okay, we want to get pregnant in the next 6 to 12 months, maybe even a year or two down the road? What should we be thinking about and doing now?
It's a great question. And I think it's really easy to get overwhelmed by it. Like, oh my gosh, there's all these things that I have to do. When really a lot of it is just like, it's a kind of a check-in, kind of like what I did with my health. It's a good check-in. Where are you at? Like, do you feel balanced in your life right now? Where are your stressors? Mapping out your journey is really, can be a helpful thing. And then the biggest thing that I think for women that we need to do, and we don't talk enough about, is really like release the expectations that you might have about how this journey may go. Because when you're trying to conceive, it can take some time. Sometimes it doesn't take time. Sometimes it just happens. And many women are just completely surprised by a pregnancy, and that's its own journey on its own. Like, that's a whole other conversation. But it can take some time, and every month can be filled with this roller coaster ride of expectation and then disappointment, or maybe, oh my goodness, maybe I'm pregnant. Nope, I'm not. And then you have this like these big roller coaster rides. So figure out a way that you're going to be able to manage that and really talk to your partner about that, because it's a huge source of stress for women trying to get pregnant. So starting that conversation really early, and maybe you'll get pregnant right away, but you know, most women, it takes 3 to 9 months, if not sometimes a year, to conceive, mostly because not all of us ovulate every single month. And that's actually quite normal. I mean, you want to ovulate more months than not, but it's normal to miss a month of ovulation and you won't get pregnant at that time. Or, you know, it's quite miraculous. Pregnancy in itself is quite miraculous, and really honoring that for what it is important. You want to make sure that you understand your cycle. So starting to track your cycle, if you don't already. For me, I use this Bluetooth thermometer. So I track my cycle just by using temperature and by checking cervical mucus. And there's lots of guides out there. We'll include that in our Baby Making and Beyond too, about how to track your cycle. But getting to know your cycle and your most fertile days so you can maximize your chances of success will be important. Look at your lifestyle habits. So, you know, are you going to CrossFit 6 days a week? You probably want to dial that back. Like, preconception and pregnancy is not the time to hit your like PRs. It's the time to really dial it back and nourish your parasympathetic nervous system. Slow everything down. Tell your body it's safe and just chill out. So, you know, look at your lifestyle habits. If you were to pick one exercise to do, you know, I would say, you know, keep going CrossFit, just go like 2-3 days a week max, and then do a lot of gentle movement and walking. Super important. Look at your diet. Make sure that you have a really nutrient dense diet filled with lots of whole foods. There's no magic diet plan. We talk about some like superfoods and Baby Making and Beyond, but really there's no magic bullet. There's no magic tea. You just want to make sure that you're filling yourself up with a rainbow of foods. And then finally, you know, supplementation. A lot of people get worked up about supplements, but the thing to remember about supplements is that they're just supplements. They supplement your diet. So you want to make sure that you're getting lots of folate and D, as well as a little bit of vitamin A, not so much from retinol, from liver, but also from beta carotene. So by taking like a really good prenatal vitamin, I usually recommend the Seeking Health brand because it kind of is like got everything in it. If I was to design one, I would probably get that, design that. So I would say, you know, do a prenatal vitamin and you're like good to go. It's not that complicated. It's just like just a little bit of thoughtfulness and mindfulness about it. And I think the biggest piece that you can really, you know, if you take home one thing from that is to like spend some time with the spiritual side of yourself, releasing your expectations and figure out how you're going to nourish your heart during that process.
Oh, Meg, that's so hard.
I know. I know.
You have just told us to do the impossible, but it's so...
It's so hard.
It's important.
I get it.
Yeah. It's hard. I think that what you're saying is a lot of balance will come from letting go of having a bunch of expectations and trying to control and speaking from experience. You know, we want to be able to control everything, and so we get hyper-focused on... what are the foods and what's the best prenatal and all this stuff? And sometimes that can be the detriment to your health and to the whole process of baby making. And so there's absolutely things you can do. I will link to the Seeking Health prenatal in the show notes. And then there's also one that I personally, another one that's very similar that I take. Meg also mentioned folate. So it's really important to focus on getting in additional folate. And what would you say... when would you start to kind of ramp that up? At what point pre-planning on starting to try? Because I've heard a lot of recommendations of, you know, from as far as my doctor said that if I'm in childbearing years, I should just be taking a prenatal anyway to, oh, you need to start 3 to 6 months ahead of time taking your prenatal. Like, when should you start taking that prenatal and making sure that you are taking folate, which is... you know, the actual form of B9, which we want in our bodies, not necessarily the synthetic B9, which is called folic acid.
Yeah, that's right. I think, I mean, we say 3 to 6 months. If you're basically, if you're having unprotected sex, you should be taking a good prenatal. If, you know, if your plan is to conceive one day, I think it really varies, you know, for people who might have an MTHFR mutation where their need for folate is greater. Those people, you know, if they're thinking about babies, they should just be on folate because they need it just for their body's healthy functioning anyways. If you know what your MTHFR status is and you have a really good nutrient dense diet and you don't have any mutations, you know, a month or two in advance is totally reasonable.
Okay, so this next question, what can you do to help fertility after 30? So I've actually gotten this question quite a bit too, because as you know, a lot of the trends, which I did cover in a few episodes ago, is, you know, the age at which women are having their first children or first child, their first child in a set of children, if that's what they choose, is the age is rising. I think it's now 26 or 27, and a lot of women are having their first babies after age 30, which I'm one of them. So what can you do to help fertility after 30? Are there things that can be done within a year of starting to try that will help increase fertility and make a possible pregnancy easier / less risky?
That's a great question. 30, you're a baby. You're still good. You're still good. After the age of 35 and then again after the age of 40, that's when our risk factors do increase. It takes longer to become pregnant, and pregnancy itself, the body, your body doesn't support a pregnancy as easily as it might in your 20s or early 30s. So, you know, 35 seems to be the magic number. And then 40 again after that, things take another like little blip towards the more risky side of things. But you know, trust that your body still works really well in your early 30s and even into your late 30s. I know lots of moms who have conceived after the age of 35 without any issues. That being said, I totally get that you want to do all the things that make it easier. So one of the big things, like we just talked about, would be a good prenatal vitamin. There's two other supplements that can really help with egg quality and egg health. And most of the fertility clinics are actually recommending them now, which is really cool. They've kind of recognized the power of these two nutrients. One is coenzyme Q10. So CoQ10 basically acts as a really strong antioxidant, and it particularly targets your ovaries and your eggs. So all of the DNA that's in your eggs, it just stays a little bit stronger. So the little connecting portions of your DNA that hold it together in its shape, they just stay stronger. And things that can increase your risk of translocation mutations, so things like Down syndrome, for example, that's the most commonly known translocation mutation, would be when those spindles get kind of fragile and break. So coenzyme Q10 helps to keep them strong. And you want to take the sweet spot for coenzyme Q10 is about 600 milligrams a day. So you can add that one in. The other one is melatonin. Melatonin is that hormone that helps us to sleep. It's one, as a midwife, I know very well because I take it and I have taken it for years. It as well acts as an antioxidant, particularly targeting the ovaries, and also helps with your circadian rhythm, which is incredibly important for fertility. So those would be the two things that I would add in. And then other than that, the lifestyle things that we talked about before, the just chilling out, can be really helpful. Making sure that your thyroid and your vitamin D levels are all good beforehand can be really helpful as well. And supplementing with additional thyroid support as well as vitamin D will make it a little bit easier. That's about it.
So the melatonin supplementation, I'm guessing you're meaning taking that at night. And does it have any sort of addictive properties? Do you start taking it? Can you not stop taking it? Like, what? How does that work?
Yeah, melatonin, it doesn't actually have a physiological addictive property. You take it, it hits its peak concentration, I think, at around 2 hours after you take it. It's mostly out of your system 4 to 12 hours later. So it doesn't really linger. And most of the addictive qualities are psychological. So, you know, you just think you need to take it to fall asleep, but it doesn't actually have like a physiological addictive component. Your pineal gland in your brain makes it on its own. And you're probably, I mean, most people make their own melatonin completely sufficiently. This is just, you're not so much taking it to help you sleep. You're taking it because it's such a strong, wonderful antioxidant that really targets your ovaries. And so what the research seems to show is about 2 to 3 milligrams a night can be quite helpful.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Okay. So next question, and this is a question that we got from a lot of people, specifically in private DMs. Hi, I would love to ask a question about fertility post-miscarriage. I recently lost my baby girl at 12 weeks. She died at 9, so it was a missed miscarriage. I had a D&C on December 29th, so it's been a month and no period back yet. I know there's a large spectrum of normal, but I can't help but be anxious about my fertility. It took me a year to get pregnant with my first daughter and a year to get pregnant with this one too. I've had some issues with my hormones relating to post Mirena IUD before my first child, and then post breastfeeding. It took almost 9 months to get my cycle back. I'm going to acupuncture and eating blood building foods. I'm exercising regularly but lightly. Some people say you are more fertile post miscarriage, but I don't want to be too hopeful to just be disappointed. Looking for any information on this. Thanks, and love you gals for all you do. You've helped me overcome so much. So just to preface this, we had a lot of, I had a miscarriage, now what? Or I've had a miscarriage and now I have a lot of time that I still am not pregnant again. And I think that I still haven't gotten a regular cycle, or my cycles are a little off. What can women do when they go through this experience to really help their fertility, whether mental, emotional, or supplements or whatever?
Oh man, I feel for this woman. It's so common, yet we don't talk about it enough, and we don't support each other as women enough through this, I think. Something that we tend to keep quite private, and it can be really lonely feeling this way. So, you know, I really encourage her to reach out to her friends and family just for support, and sometimes having someone knowing and holding that space for you can be really helpful. The fact that she hasn't had a period in a month is not terribly surprising. After a D&C, which is when they basically take all of the uterine lining out of your uterus, your uterine lining becomes quite thin. And in order for you to have a period and be able to conceive, you need to have a nice thick uterine lining, which builds up again over time as your estrogen levels will increase again. And so if you haven't had it in a month, it's not surprising. Your uterine lining might just have been too thin to shed. You still might have ovulated, but you might not have had a period, if that makes sense. So I would give that just a little bit more time, and it will likely come back in the next month or so. You want to remember that you can still ovulate even if you haven't had a period. So if you're doing any tracking with a thermometer, that might help just to see if you get like a sustained rise in your basal body temperature. That sustained rise tells us that we've ovulated. So looking for that rise will tell you that your body is ovulating again. If you see in your basal body temps, if you see lots of up and down squiggly lines and not really any pattern, that's saying that you're not ovulating and that most important thing for you to work on is ovulation. In order to ovulate, your body needs to feel safe and it needs to be well nourished. And it sounds like you're doing all of the things that you need to do in terms of movement. So keeping it really light and gentle. I know, I think she said in here too, that she was just doing walking and yoga, which is perfect and beautiful. That's just what you should be doing. And eating blood building foods. So from the Chinese medicine perspective, blood building foods are usually things that will help build up that uterine lining again. And they're often really nourishing, nutrient dense foods that we would include anyways. So making sure that you're getting a really good diet and you have enough calories. If you have another little one, sometimes moms forget to eat enough. So making sure calorically you're sustaining yourself well. You're not going hungry, you're not waiting too long between meals, which can cause some blood sugar imbalance that can make it a little trickier. That's one thing you can do. And really make sure that your, again, your thyroid and your vitamin D are in check. Those are really big things to help women conceive and can be really easy fix. So make sure, especially now that you're postpartum, your thyroid can fluctuate. Make sure that your provider checks your thyroid, and not just checking it with a TSH, which is your thyroid stimulating hormone, but doing a full thyroid panel to really get the full picture of what your thyroid health is doing. That's super important. I have a really long document in our Baby Making and Beyond that talks about how the thyroid, the adrenal axis, so that adrenal axis is the thing that creates that cortisol imbalance and the adrenal fatigue that everyone talks about all the time, and your ovaries, so your gonadal axis, they're all incredibly connected. And if one little piece of that puzzle is out of balance, then it'll throw all of the other things out of balance. So it's really important to make sure that you're taking care of all of those pieces, including the thyroid. Some people find, again, you know, to maximize melatonin levels and circadian rhythm, that blue blocking glasses might be helpful for you at nighttime. So that's something you can look into, but you're really doing a great job by going to acupuncture, and it sounds like you're caring for yourself well. Sometimes women who have had a long journey in the road to conception and becoming a parent, which it sounds like she has, having some touch therapy can be quite lovely and healing. So touch therapy comes in lots of different forms. Some people go to a Reiki practitioner. Some people will try like a Rubenfeld Synergy practitioner, but just, or even just having a really good healing massage can be really helpful. Sometimes we underestimate the power of gentle touch, and, you know, touch can come from our partners, but sometimes just having someone that's there with the direct purpose of just caring for you and touching you in a healing way can really be calming to our bodies and our minds and our spirits too.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I haven't heard a lot about the touch therapy, but it makes a lot of sense, because I feel like when you are suffering from anxiety, especially when it's relating to losing a child and or not being able to get pregnant for a long time, you need that embrace. You know, there's always things that you can do, but you cannot... It's so underestimated, the power of touch and being held and hugged and cared for. And I had Eliza Parker on recently on the podcast, and she was talking about how babies express themselves through crying and through the release of tension. And when that happens, it's really important to do that in arms. In other words, to kind of embrace your child and listen and to make sure that they know that they're heard, and to kind of, you know, draw close to them in those moments. And it really clicked for me because I've talked openly about my miscarriage experience on here, and I will, just to relate to you, which it is a private DM, so we're not going to say her name, but just to relate, like, you know, going through it is a very lonely experience because you don't necessarily want to talk about it to a lot of people. It's just like, you know, you want to process it on your own terms, and or you just, it's not something you really want to, like, put on speaker, right? And so when it, you do go through it, I remember reaching out to a few other bloggers and being like, is there any sort of, like, closed Facebook group I can join just to kind of, like, talk through support for this, or, you know, just getting some help about how to process it or relate to other people? And it was like, oh, no, I don't know. And, you know, I wanted to kind of find that community. And it's really hard. It doesn't really exist unless you really try to look for it. And I'm sure that there's probably more resources now and more people talking about it now. But yeah, it's a lonely experience, and it can be very anxiety producing in those situations. So if you don't actually process and deal with it, and you let that anxiety take over, especially at night, when, like what you're saying now, which is the most important thing for our hormones, is really to have a circadian rhythm, to let that melatonin be, you know, reach its peak, and to be sufficiently getting enough sleep and all that kind of stuff, and be repairing, you know, that's really important to this HPA axis and evolving the ovaries and the gonads. It's like crazy how much that impacts your fertility. And so, like, the anxiety around that whole process and not processing it can really be debilitating, you know? And so in those moments, I remember I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would just want my husband to hold me. And that was kind of the way that I was able to process through some of that stuff, you know, being held, being able to cry, not necessarily having to talk about it, but being able to process. And it's profound. I think it's so underestimated how much anxiety impacts overall health and hormonal health and or stress. And I know that so many people hate this phrase, but when you stop trying to get pregnant is when a lot of people get pregnant. And I understand that people hate that because everybody is like, no, I don't want to get to the point where I just stop trying. And I hear you. But the idea behind that is, you stop obsessing, right? It's not the thing that makes you, it's making you anxious and stressed out month after month. And so once that stress melts away, so if you can figure out, you know, the whole goal is, let's figure out how to make that happen while you're still trying. Let's figure out how to manage that stress and process that anxiety and get help. And you're doing that, you know, you're doing that with the acupuncture and all that kind of stuff. And all the things that Meg has suggested is kind of taking all of that into account, the emotional, the physical, and the mental aspect of it all. So fertility is so complicated, man. It's like,
it is so complicated. Yeah. It's such a miracle when we become pregnant. And
yes.
It really is. And, you know, the other thing I might mention for her too, and I know Liz has talked about it a little bit, is journaling your feelings and your emotions as you're in the moment. Journaling can be such a beautiful form of release. It can take a creative form. So if you want to turn it into, like, writing some poetry, I know that sounds like a bit of a cliche and a little weird, but it actually can be quite a helpful, beautiful exercise.
Yeah, no, I don't think anything sounds weird anymore because all the weird things always work really well. And just to kind of touch on that, this the next question is, can you have a healthy pregnancy? And this is kind of what we were just talking about, with less than stellar adrenal function. She's asking for a friend. She says she's working on lowering her cortisol, but wants to get pregnant soon and doesn't want to make it difficult for herself or the pregnancy with whacked out cortisol levels.
Totally. You can 100% get pregnant. You would be surprised how many people get pregnant with cortisol issues. It can happen. The big thing is that everyone's different, and some people whose cortisol is high, you know, and I'm guessing she's talking about, like, subclinically high, because people who have, you know, clinically high cortisol, you know, are in a disease state and they need to be under the treatment of a medical doctor. But people who just, you know, have, you know, high normal cortisol, so are just living in a high stress situation, get pregnant all the time. Some people's ability to ovulate is changed by cortisol, while some people are a little bit more resilient. And that just, you know, brings us to the spectrum of, you know, snowflakes. Everyone is so unique and no one is quite totally alike. So the big thing would be, again, tracking your cycle, making sure you know if you're ovulating. And if you are, that's great. You're good. Now just focus on the stress pieces and how to manage those pieces of stress. I don't ever recommend for people who are thinking about conception right away, trying any of any aggressive supplementation programs. It's better just to keep it clean in your body, just with a solid nutrient-dense diet. And then the piece of advice that nobody likes to hear is the caring for yourself piece. So, you know, again, I can't stress the importance of sleep and gentle movement. Ideally, you know, if you're dealing with high cortisol, you really want your movement to be outside in nature. They've done some studies where they've looked at, moving, walking on a treadmill versus walking on a street versus walking in a forest or on the beach or, you know, in a beautiful field somewhere in the mountains. And they found that people who move outside in nature tend to lower their cortisol as they're walking. So walking does two great benefits for you. It not only lowers your cortisol, but it also helps to balance your insulin levels and your blood sugar levels, which also need to be in good shape for when you're trying to conceive, and can also be affected when your cortisol is a little bit out of whack. Because when your cortisol is out of whack, your insulin levels get a little bit out of whack and your blood sugar also gets a little bit out of whack. So walking is such a beautiful restorative thing that you can do for yourself. If you have no access to those, you know, beautiful outdoor spaces, then, you know, just choosing to walk outside, you know, smelling all the smells as we move into spring, we're going to be, you know, there's going to be cherry blossoms here in Vancouver, like taking some time to smell the roses. It sounds like a cliche, but it really works. Will be one of the best things you can do.
Okay, so now let's talk about pregnancy. This is from EK Bove 13. I'm currently 22 weeks pregnant with my first baby. I have a history of anxiety and sleep problems, so I'm already nervous about those baby blues, postpartum anxiety, and trouble sleeping. Any suggestions to prevent or deal with these problems before they happen? Would love any advice you have to share. This is a very big topic, but
totally.
Yeah.
But there's really cool, simple things that she can do. And I think so many women are nervous about that. And first of all, kudos for her for, like, you know, being really proactive about that, knowing your history and like setting up a good plan so that if it does happen, you're prepared. You know, the worst thing that can happen is you end up with postpartum anxiety and depression and, you know, had no history of it and were totally taken off guard. That can be really difficult, but like good on her for like really wanting to take the bull by the horn, so to speak. First of all, trusting that your body is going to be okay is a big thing. Mostly, your hormones are set up postpartum to really try to keep anxiety low. So what I mean by that is once you have the baby and your body starts producing the hormone prolactin, which is the prolactation hormone that our bodies make as soon as our placentas are out of them, it is a really cool hormone because it works as actually a natural antidepressant and a natural anti-anxiety hormone. It doesn't work all the time for all women, but for a lot of women, and when our bodies are functioning well in nature, prolactin is wonderful. It helps to calm and actually kind of works like progesterone, so it's a very calming hormone. So your body will be producing that, so you can trust that that will help. If nothing else, oftentimes when people ask me about, just as a side note, ask about like post-weaning anxiety, it's often that withdrawal from prolactin that they're experiencing. That's why they get a kind of a rebound of anxiety and depression, which is kind of an interesting little tidbit for people to be aware of. So trust that your body is like trying to set you up for success. The things that you can do to help support that success are, you know, number one, create a really good support network. If you're starting to feel anxious postpartum, a lot of it can have to do with just simple sleep deprivation. So coming up with a plan for how you're going to care for yourself during a time of, you know, guaranteed sleep deprivation. Whether that means, you know, if you're choosing to breastfeed, you know, pumping and having your partner give some pump milk at night so you can have a bit of a longer stretch of sleep. It seems like getting a stretch of sleep that's 4 hours or greater really can do wonders if you're experiencing postpartum anxiety. So, you know, having that piece close at hand. So maybe you want to invest in, you know, an inexpensive breast pump. That might be a helpful thing. The other thing you can do is making sure that you have enough DHA and EPA fatty acids in your body. There's been a lot of really good research on essential fatty acid deficiency and postpartum anxiety and mood disorders. So you want to make sure you're getting that either from your diet by eating fatty fish. It seems like the sweet spot for fatty fish is like at least 2 to 3 times a week. Whether that be salmon or sardines or mackerel, making sure you're getting that into your body. Or you can take a supplement that works great. I don't know what you think, but I don't usually recommend people do fish oil anymore. I like the fish oil that has a little bit of EPA and phospholipids in it just to help with absorption. And there's lots of good companies making that these days, which is great. Mm-hmm. And the other really cool thing that I'm learning more about now that has a lot of potential in the future is amino acids, taking amino acids postpartum, specifically tyrosine and tryptophan. These two amino acids work to increase your body's MAOA receptors, which help to produce things like serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine, which make you feel chilled out, relaxed, and our natural anti-anxiety hormones. So boosting your intake of tryptophan either through food, which are usually like protein-rich food. Everyone always thinks about turkey, but specifically they're coming out with amino acid supplements that show a lot of promise postpartum. Of course, like most things, they haven't done a lot of studies on pregnant women and postpartum women, and they never will because it's totally unethical to run clinical trials on pregnant and postpartum women. However, we can assume that these things will be safe because they are simply amino acids. And amino acids are things that we get through our diet. They're the building blocks of protein. And so we can assume that they'll be quite safe for postpartum, and that might be something to look into as well.
And the fish oil thing, do you guys recommend, because I've been, maybe I will have Liz back on to talk about cod liver oil and, you know, fish oil supplementation, because I've been really interested in all the research that she's doing about that and what you guys are putting in the program. You guys are recommending either no fish oil at all or a high quality fish oil supplement, or do you recommend doing like a extra virgin cod liver oil maybe once a week? What are your thoughts there? Because I'm sure everybody was like, huh, what do I do? Because a lot, you know, EPA and DHA is what they, I know a lot of people are focused on, especially if you're vegetarian or something like that. You know, that's what doctors harp on and recommend.
And, you know, I think that's going to change maybe sooner than later. In terms of like let's just talk about the cod liver oil. The big thing with the cod liver oil is that, is the vitamin A. And I know it can be a little bit, go against the grain. You know, we used to talk about how, and I used to too, how important liver is and vitamin A is, especially for fertility and pregnancy. But what we know is that we actually don't know a lot. We do know that high levels of vitamin A retinol, so the vitamin A you get from animal sources, which would be like a cod liver oil, in high doses, it can be teratogenic, which means that it causes birth defects. And the problem with cod liver oil is that, you know, from tablespoon to tablespoon to tablespoon, we don't know how much vitamin A is in there. And not knowing is not good enough when you're pregnant. You know, you really want to know, especially if you're dealing with something that has a potential and, a very proven potential to cause things like birth defects. So really exercise caution with the cod liver oil. If you like taking it and you feel good with it, that's fine. You know, just take it at the low dose and not every day. So you really want to minimize your exposure. But what we really recommend and what all the research that Liz and myself and Amanda have done quite tirelessly is looking at doing like a fish oil is fine, but really having the balance of EPA fatty acids as well as phospholipids It helps them all work together, and it helps it be absorbed, and it helps your body process it more efficiently and get it to where it needs to go. And there have been some studies that showed that just like DHA on its own without the EPA, not so much without the phospholipids, but without the EPA, can actually be harmful. I think we're going to see more research evolve in that front over the next few years. It just seems like it's very on the forefront. But there's a lot of companies now that are making these omega-3 supplements with that blend. I know Seeking Health is one. Nordic Naturals has a good one. Those are the ones that I can think of offhand. But having that balance is going to be really important.
Okay, so Seeking Health, and you said Nordic Naturals?
Nordic Naturals has one too, yeah. So you want to look for the phospholipid portion as well. Phospholipids are a fatty acid. They're in much smaller doses, but they help our bodies absorb the triglycerides and the DHA and EPA.
Got it. Okay. I'm going to find those and link to those in the show notes. So I just wanted to make sure we got them down. Okay. So moving on into the postpartum experience, what lab tests would you suggest if you feel like your hormones are out of balance 5 months plus postpartum? And would you suggest tracking hormone levels long term as a woman? She said she had postpartum preeclampsia and anxiety, but still experiences symptoms of either thyroid dysfunction or adrenal estrogen dominance. So this is a really big question, and I think can apply to many women. So even if you've had children or not, do you recommend women getting hormones tested on a regular basis? And if so, what should we be testing? What should we be looking at?
I think, I don't usually recommend people test their hormones postpartum. I think it depends, first of all, whether you're breastfeeding or not. If you're breastfeeding, don't test your hormones, because they're going to not be in line with what is, normal. Your prolactin is going to be high, your progesterone and estrogen are going to be low, and that's pretty much what you'll see. So don't waste your money if you're breastfeeding. Wait until you have weaned, and wait at least 3 to 6 months post-weaning before spending a lot of money on expensive testing. If you're not breastfeeding and your cycle has returned, again, 3 to 6 months is a good time to consider hormone tracking. But only if you're really struggling. These tests are really expensive, but they can be quite helpful. So for people who are struggling quite a bit, I like the Dutch test. I use it a lot in my practice. I like how it gives you kind of a good panel of all of your hormones, as well as some markers of oxidative stress that might be happening in your body. It tells you what your cortisol levels are doing. It tells you what your melatonin levels are doing, as well as all of your sex hormones. So that's pretty cool. It'll tell you if you have estrogen dominance, which is great. The one thing that the Dutch test, however, doesn't do is thyroid. You can easily test your thyroid yourself using one of the, online tests. I usually recommend Everly Well to people. People seem to really enjoy that test. Thyroid is one of the tests, though, however, you can do when you are postpartum and a breastfeeding woman, and it's important that you do get your thyroid tested at least 3 months after birth. Most practitioners, like pregnancy care practitioners, so OBGYN, a midwife, they should all test your thyroid to make sure it's not taking a dip, which it often will in the postpartum period. Estrogen dominance for a postpartum woman is so common. And it's part of the cycle of normal too. So I think it's important to normalize some of this stuff, not just assume that, oh my gosh, I have estrogen dominance, there's something wrong. As your body gets back into balance, it's going to naturally be a little bit estrogen dominant, as oftentimes you're not ovulating monthly. And in order for you to get out of the cycle of estrogen dominance, you have to be ovulating every month so that your progesterone levels will rise to balance out your estrogen, right? Because estrogen dominance just isn't an abundance of estrogen. It's an imbalance of estrogen to progesterone. So as you ovulate more regularly monthly, as your cycle normalizes, it's naturally going to correct itself. In the meantime, though, things that you can do to support that happening are all of the things we've talked about. So the trying to get as much sleep as you can, the trying to incorporate some gentle movement, trying to like bring stress levels down and make your body feel safe as well as being well nourished. All those are going to be super important.
And then you mentioned breastfeeding, and we've gotten quite a few questions about how do you prepare your body for baby number two? Because we have this thing going where we spent 9 months creating a human life, and now we're breastfeeding and all these nutrients are going to this human again. And so how do you prepare for baby number two? And what's the hormonal situation when you're breastfeeding? Can you get pregnant while still breastfeeding baby number one for those who want to do extended breastfeeding? What's that look like? Denise asked how to build up your stores, dealing with stress, tracking, especially how nursing impacts fertility. My cycle has been back for about 6 months, but it is long. So I think one of those questions that a lot of people get too is, I stopped breastfeeding and my cycles are still all over the place. Like, how do I fix this?
Yeah, sometimes it just takes time to normalize. That's the hard thing, is that it's like the tincture of time is like the hardest medicine to take. You can still totally get pregnant if you're breastfeeding. It happens all the time. Usually it's not when you're exclusively breastfeeding. So exclusive breastfeeding, which means that your baby's not having solids, you're nursing through the night, usually up until the age of 6 months, is really good, a really good form of contraception. Like, it's 98% chance of success. So, you know, it's better than the IUD in terms of preventing a pregnancy. Once you're not doing exclusive breastfeeding anymore, especially when your baby starts not nursing through the night, that's when your fertility often will return and when your hormones will start to balance. So if you are a breastfeeding mom, that's kind of the golden ticket towards having your fertility return, is then the night nursing seems to make a really big impact. Again, probably having to do with those melatonin levels and circadian rhythms returning. And also because at nighttime, your prolactin levels, so that breastfeeding hormone, is the highest. And when you have the stimulus of a baby nursing, that hormone is going to go even higher. So when that hormone is really high, it stops you from ovulating. So it will prevent ovulation. It'll prevent an LH surge in your brain, which tells your body to ovulate. So having those prolactin levels coming down are going to be really key to having your fertility come back to normal. The big piece is making sure that you're managing stress levels well. So doing whatever you can in terms of self-care. I know, especially in the United States, you guys, your mat leaves are not long enough. And so oftentimes I talk to women who have like, they'll be like, I had a baby and I went to work, you know, and 2 months after that, and, you know, I'm still working full time and I'm juggling daycare and my older child and my hormones are out of balance. And why? Like, why is this happening? It's like, well, girl, you're doing everything. And, you know, my hormones wouldn't work either, because your output energetically, spiritually, and just, you know, in terms of like a time commitment is incredibly insane. And so it might be, you know, worth looking at, you know, how to do less in order to care for yourself. And that's a conversation you need to have as a family. I know not everyone can have the luxury of taking some time off or reducing the amount of time they spend working or having a little bit of support in terms of getting some childcare so that you can go out and, you know, go for that walk or do whatever you need, go to that yoga class to nourish yourself. But sometimes that's the biggest piece. And it's not so much about, you know, taking a supplement or, you know, there's no like magic acupuncture point that will help with that. It's oftentimes that self-care piece. And man, it's hard to accept that piece.
Oh, so hard, Meg.
I wish that there was something, you know, some magical formula. And if I come up with that formula, I'll never have to be on call again, because I'll just be on a beach somewhere in Mexico.
Yeah.
We have to learn in our modern day society how to care for ourselves well again. And we're just not very good at it, myself included. But really,
having a conversation with the people that love you and coming up with like a team plan and taking some of that burden off you, like you have to do all of these things. Well, actually y'all might have to do it all. Like you have to, might have to just work as a team to try to figure out how to make this happen for you. And then, you know, if you're having multiple babies, the other important piece is to make sure you're continuing to take that prenatal. I should also just mention that because it's super important. Having babies close together can be really depleting on your system. So making sure that you're putting as much in as is coming out, both in terms of calorie levels and also nutrient levels, is going to be super duper important.
Yeah, and I just to speak from personal experience too, I did conceive while I was still breastfeeding Stella, and then when you get pregnant, your milk actually dries up pretty significantly, and that happened within 6 weeks. And so I was actually just breastfeeding her in the morning and at night when I got pregnant. Once in the morning, sorry, and once before she went to bed, and it was not the main source of nutrition. It was just a little boost. So I think my body, and I was feeling great. I had energy again. I was like ready to get back into working out, and I had started more intense working out again, and it was like, boom, we got pregnant. So I think you'll find a good, like, so both of these questions came from moms who have children around a year old, and that's a really, that's still, you're still in the thick of the first child and probably nursing a lot, and, you know, it's depending on your child, you could still be nursing at night. And so I think as you naturally start to introduce more solid foods and maybe do start to night wean and your child sleeps through the night, you'll start to feel shifts, not only in your own body, you know, your energy levels, but also in, like, I feel like people get a little bit more like, oh, I have, you know, I feel like I'm not so dragged down anymore. I do feel like I can take care of myself again, because breastfeeding is very selfless. I mean, you just kind of feel like you're managed, you know, you're, and it's a beautiful thing and it's wonderful, but it is a lot of self, it's a lot of self-sacrifice, a lot of giving, and especially if you're still doing it at night. And so I think you'll find that you can kind of hit a stride if you do, like you said, kind of focus on where are we at with the night situation. And I've seen a lot of people have success after night weaning, getting their periods back to a little bit more of a regular cycle. And gosh, what you said in the beginning about melatonin, like that's applying a lot here too. So yeah. Okay. So let's do one more question. Can we do that? Okay. Yeah. So we're going to wrap it up. One last question. And we do get this question a lot. Can someone please talk about post-weaning baby hormones? Mine still haven't gone back to normal. Anxiety, nausea during period, cramp, pain worse than ever. That's just all changes. No one warned me of this, that this was even a possibility. I heard hormones change after you have the baby, but never when you wean. What happens when you wean? What is this thing that nobody tells us about, that when you wean, you sort of feel like crud? And I had another person comment too, you know, I'd love to hear about the same topic. My anxiety got much worse after weaning. I'm still trying to figure out, and it's been months.
For some women, it can make their periods better. And for some women, it can make them worse. And if you get the worst end of that spectrum, that is like a really bum deal. It sucks. It's not fun. But it will get better again over time. A lot of like what I had talked about earlier in terms of that, the anxiety levels really peaking after you wean, is the decrease in the hormone prolactin, like we talked about, which is that natural calming hormone that goes down. And oftentimes you can get some rebound anxiety because you're going through almost like a prolactin withdrawal, as well as oxytocin levels. So when you're breastfeeding, your oxytocin levels go up. It's one of the few times where oxytocin levels do spike, is like breastfeeding, when you're making love to someone you are loved and connected to, as well as when you're giving birth. So when you're not breastfeeding anymore, you're not getting that constant supply of oxytocin, which just is like the feel good hormone, makes you feel awesome. So oftentimes that shift in mood has to do with those two hormones going down. And also when those two hormones go down, your estrogen levels go up. And for some women, rising estrogen can really throw like a curveball in life in general. That sounds like what is going on with her. I know, I think you said she had heavy periods and cramps and all of those great things that are no fun at all. And so oftentimes that is attributed to a bit of an estrogen dominant situation. So having more estrogen than you do progesterone, all of that sort of thing will normalize once you start ovulating regularly. So what I would encourage her to do is to track her temperatures and to make sure that she's actually ovulating. If she is ovulating, sometimes giving it 3 to 6 months is can be really helpful, just time alone. As your progesterone levels go up, your estrogen will naturally go down. There's no magic bullet. I mean, some people will tell you to take things like Vitex or Maca. Sometimes Vitex can be a little bit helpful because what Vitex does is it works to lower prolactin levels, so it can help bring those levels down even more, so your estrogen levels can rise even more, which actually can help you ovulate. It's really personal, and it's one of those like questions where it's like, oh, it totally depends. But all of those things that you can do to manage your HPA axis or your cortisol levels will all help in this situation. Again, to that postpartum piece about mood and the amino acids that we talked about earlier might be really helpful. So those amino acids, again, were tryptophan and tyrosine. You might want to look into that. Acupuncture can be really helpful in terms of normalizing those hormones in the postpartum, post-weaning phase too. So going to see a good acupuncture practitioner would be really helpful, as well as making sure you're getting enough of those fatty acids that we talked about too. Again, really, really helpful. Other than that, I know it sounds terrible, but it really is just a matter of normalizing things and letting your body return to its balance. Some people do that faster than others. And again, looking at the lifestyle piece. So if you're one of those moms that's like, okay, I'm like back at work right away and I'm doing all of these things, you know, it's like, it's kind of like the same answer to every question. It's like, okay, well, really have a really solid look at what's going on in your life and how you can balance all of the commitments that you have in terms of, you know, your energy output and put more back into yourself.
Meg, you're awesome. So I know you're working on Baby Making It Beyond, and you guys have been doing that for a very long time, and there is so much information in this online encyclopedia, as you called it before we jumped on. 250,000 words. Is that correct? Did I say that correctly? Yeah. Which our book, by the way, Coconuts and Kettlebells, is only 60,000, and it's a 300-page book. So if that gives you any insight into what Baby Making and Beyond is going to be, it's going to be huge. It's literally an encyclopedia like that you can reference when you have questions about anything pre, during pregnancy, postpartum, parenthood. I think it's going to be a lot of great. I mean, it's going to be what is that thing that you remember when you used to buy the CDs when they were encyclopedias, Encyclopedia Britannica, and you'd put it in, and it was like this whole world where you could, you know, this was pre. This would be all on the internet now, right? But it's going to sort of be like that, where you just access that you put in the CD, in the CD-ROM drive, and you have access to all of this research and information, and you can ask questions and find answers. And I think I just can't wait for it to come out. And tell us about when it is going to come out and when you hope it's going to come out, and kind of where you're at right now with it.
Yeah, we're getting like closer every single day. It's just a lot of editing. When you have that much content, you have to make sure that, you know, I'm like the queen of spelling mistakes and grammatical errors. So like going through it with a fine tooth comb just takes time. So that's what we're doing now. And likely we'll end up launching it in segments. So we've already got the core 4 ready, and that's been beta tested, and we're just making the changes based on what our beta testers, the feedback we got, which is great. The core 4 is all the pieces of the puzzle. So like things like movement, nutrition, supplementation, and stress and sleep. So those are kind of the main tenets. And you find that all of the research takes you back to these core 4 recommendations, which is actually really cool. And the greatest thing about them is like, we kind of had these ideas for the core 4. They've changed a little bit as we've done all of the research, but really it's like, it's good, solid, evidence-based info. And it's cool because we dive into like all of the nerdy parts of it. So if people are really like into the nerdy science bits, we have a little bit of that, but we also have like some very easy to follow, like very general recommendations, as well as kind of a guide to when you do become pregnant, you know, what to expect in the first, second, third trimester, and what you can do to support your body to have a healthy birth and healthy baby, as well as how to survive the postpartum period, which is like such a big part that we don't necessarily think about when we're even thinking of trying to conceive. But it actually can last the longest. So it's going to be a super comprehensive encyclopedia.
Yay, I'm excited. We will link to your website, personal website, in the show notes, but I will plan on when Baby Making and Beyond officially launches and is available, whenever that is, hopefully that's going to be spring of 2019, I will go and drop the link in to the program in the show notes of this episode. So even if it's longer or it comes out after this episode airs, I will still go back and link to it in the show notes so people can go and get it, because podcasts live forever. So that's great.
I'm sure it will be out in completion by spring for sure.
Yes. Okay. So I will link to Meg's website in the show notes. I will link to her Instagram. So make sure to follow her in the show notes. Thank you so much, Meg, for taking all this time to answer all of our questions. We got to almost all of them, which is a really good thing. I was hoping we would get to all of them. And I would love to have you back on, hopefully, in the future, because I'm sure there's so much more we could talk about. And like you said, this is a topic that's always evolving. And as the research changes, we may have new things and discovered new ways of dealing with stress and fertility and all that stuff. So I'd love to have you back on. So thank you so much for being here.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. For more from me, you can go to coconutsandkettlebells.com. That's my website. My book, Coconuts and Kettlebells, can be found at coconutsandkettlebells.com/book. Remember, if you have a question to send Steph and I on our catch-up episodes, you can send that to wellfedwomen@gmail.com. And if you follow the Instagram account on Instagram, of course, it's @wellfedwomen. That's where we post upcoming episodes, and we ask for your questions for people like Meg. So if you have questions that you want to get in, you can follow us on Instagram @wellfedwomen, and hopefully your question will get on the show. We try to get on as many as possible within our hour plus time allotment. Thanks so much, and we will talk to you next week.